Question number one.
Tom thought the other panel would be more interesting, so he went upstairs.
Oh. Okay, we have some more questions. Maybe we'll have some time for some questions directly from the audience. Are there any governments that have an Austrian-leaning economic policy or have money that is backed by gold or silver today in the world?
I mean, there's no such thing as like pointing at a government and saying, yeah, that's, you know, approved by Hans Hoppe or anything like that. But, and on the gold thing, I don't know, maybe some of these guys know it better than I do, but I mean, I know there were things where like it was in Russia a couple of years ago and the guy, it was like their prime minister, finance minister or something was holding up a coin and saying, this is going to be the new world currency or something like that. And it was, I think it was supposed to be a gold backed thing. And then you never heard about it again. So I don't know if that guy's 6 feet under at this point or what, but, and like with China, for example, they start these things, they call them sovereign wealth funds. And they were, you know, they tout them as these things to be able to invest in non-traditional assets that central banks don't normally hold to take advantage of the growing opportunities in emerging markets. You know, really what I think it means is we want to get out of treasuries, but not say we're getting out of treasuries. And so I think you're seeing central banks around the world making moves to acquire precious metals and things like that, because they're not, you know, I don't think they're stupid. They kind of see the writing on the wall, and they know probably better than we do all the shenanigans that Bernanke and those guys are doing behind the scenes.
Question. If current policies do not change, how will the future compare to the Great Depression with regard to its severity?
I mean, if things don't change, then it won't be as bad. But you mean, if you're saying, what do we think's going to happen? Well, then yeah, I think there is going to be another crash. Like, you know, if you look at the stock market, I mean, just a naive, you don't know anything about economics, and the chart of the S&P 500 is like, and then it's back up here, and everyone's like, oh wow, good thing they did that. And so. And, you know, I think because the, you know, prospects of the U.S. economy right now are so awesome, you know, and that's why the stock market is higher than it was at the height of the bubble when everyone thought it was smooth sailing ahead. You know, that just doesn't really make any sense. So if I'm adapting what the questioner meant, I think that, yeah, there's going to be a collapse. If you're saying something like, in retrospect, are people going to look back and say this may have been worse than the Great Depression? What's funny is there are already two economists, two famous blogging economists on record saying that in their opinion, according to the criterion they're using, this recession is worse than the Great Depression. And that's Brad DeLong and Paul Krugman. Now, what's funny, they're doing it because they're trying to say, you morons, why don't you listen to us and give more stimulus? Because now it's worse than the Great Depression. And yet their whole playbook all along has been to say, it's a good thing you guys intervened somewhat, and that's what spared us from the agonies of the Great Depression. So it's like I want to say, on their own terms, their interventions and so on is worse, you know, gave us an economy that's worse than the Great Depression. So I want to say, okay, isn't that a strike against your theory? Under their own terms, we would have been better off doing nothing, because they say Herbert Hoover did nothing and that the Fed did absolutely nothing back then. So it's a weird position they're in, where they're kind of saying, if you only do 85% of what we say, it would be worse than the Great Depression. But trust us, if you just gave us that 15% more, we'd have a full recovery in 2 weeks from now. You know, so that's somewhat implausible.
Question. In light of today's economic conditions, what recommendations does the Mises Institute faculty have for college students for choosing college degrees, jobs, and careers?
Move to Panama.
Well, I'll never be as funny as Bob. Nobody is. But actually, what he just said, I want to follow up on. I think it's very good idea to prepare yourself to create value in a way that is portable. If you decide at some point that things are getting really bad in the United States, and if you happen to be an American or foreigner living here and you decide you need to leave, then it's very nice if you're prepared to leave without giving up all your ability to earn a decent income. So IT workers, for example, are quite mobile in the world. You can do almost any kind of IT work from anywhere in the world. And that's why we already have so many people in India and parts of Latin America and in Taiwan and various parts of the world that are just thick with IT workers who are working for American companies sometimes, working for European companies. So if you have any ability at all along those lines, go for it. That's the kind of skill that's going to be valuable in the foreseeable future anyhow, whether you leave the United States or not. Because, you know, you can always get a job with the NSA or or Oracle. So, which is the NSA not once removed. But at all events... think in terms of preparing yourself in a way that gives you mobility. I think you might be glad you did down the road somewhere.
A couple years ago at our October conference, the billionaire Wall Street investor Jim Rogers, who's a friend of the Austrian school, gave a talk, and he's moved to Singapore, and his children speak perfect Mandarin Chinese. And that's where he recommended. He's very high on Singapore and that part of the world. I think he also mentioned Brazil is where he's been investing a lot of money of his money in. So if you're thinking, you know, you're young and you're thinking of accumulating skills and living somewhere, a smart guy like Jim Rogers is not a bad idea to pay attention to what someone like that says.
More seriously, and I'll keep this real brief. It's the standard stock answer I give to younger people asking that kind of question is get more income, and save more. And I don't mean just like, oh, cut out one trip to Starbucks a week. I mean, you know, get a second stream or third stream of income. Don't just think, well, I have my job and that's where I get my money from, and I hope they don't lay me off. Then get out of that mentality. Start generating alternate things right now. And then save as much as you can. And like I said, I don't mean cutting back your current expenditure. I mean earn more income and then just save it. And that I think once you get out of the mentality of just thinking, well, what's my paycheck, that all of a sudden the sky's the limit when you start earning more money and you'll just see opportunities. And like Bob is saying, yeah, if you're going to hone your skills and build up your capital, your human capital, if you want to use that phrase, do it in something that doesn't tie you down to, you know, what may end up being FEMA camp number 7.
Now, even though today you can't do what people used to be able to do in the 1990s, which is just go through college and then just be assured that everything will work out, that there'll be a job in your desired field, even though things are much trickier for you guys now than they were for us some time ago, that doesn't mean that there aren't still some areas that are stable enough that there'll always be a need for them. There'll always be a need for certain services, and these are services that are portable. So, for example, one thing that especially in this period where the internet is growing by leaps and bounds, but there are still a lot of small businessmen, there's, you know, regular mom and pop operation in your town that they don't know what to do. It's probably some way that the internet could help them. They're not even going to bother trying. You can help them. You can seek them out and say, look, here's my service. It'll cost you X dollars, and look what I'll do for you. Or being able to write, I am deeply a deep admirer of people who can write good advertising copy. That is an extremely difficult thing to do, and it's acquired either through instinct or through laborious practice. But to be able to come up with a flashy headline that makes people read something or that makes somebody open that letter is – I mean, Lou Rockwell can do it, and it blows me away. The letters he writes, his titles for article, they're all clever, and that is a skill that people will pay an enormous amount for, and you can do that from anywhere. But also, I have a friend who opened up a sushi restaurant in Senegal. He lives in Jersey, and he's got two of them now, two sushi restaurants in Senegal. Because remember what Mises says about the entrepreneur. He is constantly engaged in making adjustments. There are discrepancies between input prices and expected output prices, and he's going to capitalize on that. And so it turns out that in a lot of these developing countries, there are just fortunes to be made sometimes in mundane services. Well, there are no sushi restaurants in Senegal, it turns out, until now. And what he actually did, he put out ads in France for French speakers who will come to Senegal, who know how to cook sushi, and would train all his workers in Senegal so then they could prepare sushi. Oh, well, pardon me. But it is a full service restaurant offering lots of things. But anyway, so he's actually doing extremely well. And this is when would you have thought? Well, maybe the path to riches is to go to Senegal and offer a sort of exotic product. But yet, as Doug Casey will tell you, I mean, he makes a fortune doing constantly looking at other countries where people don't think to go and offer services, and he offers them. Now, I will caution you. This friend of mine wound up one night in a Senegalese prison. He was arrested on some technicality, and he was basically they left him in there for 2 days. He didn't eat anything because he was afraid of, look, if I get the you-know-whats in prison, I just don't know what. There's no toilet. I mean, it'd just be awful. So he didn't eat anything. And this guy went to the London School of Economics. And I remember saying to him, did you sit there in prison thinking, how did I go from the London School of Economics to a Senegalese prison? So just bear in mind, there is an asterisk next to my recommendation.
And remember, you can be an entrepreneur on the side. If you've got a good paying job, you can always be an entrepreneur on the side and, you know, try things out and see what might take off. And eventually some of those entrepreneurial ideas or ventures may actually displace your regular full-time job. Again, it gives you an extra stream of income. My brother actually, on the side, he invented this thing. You've seen the signed waivers on the street, we buy gold, half off for this, half off for that. It turns out that to pay somebody to stand on the street and hold your sign, it's about $10 an hour. But if you want to get one of the professional sign holders who can spin it up in the air and twirl it and do all sorts of things, get a lot more attention, that costs $20 to $25 an hour. And my brother came up with this little invention to attach to the sign so that all you have to do is hit the sign and it twirls by itself. So you can get a $10 person if you buy this little add-on product from my brother. Okay, I teach 7th grade civics in a government school in Birmingham, Alabama. God bless you. In your opinion, or opinions, what are the most important economic concepts for 12 and 13-year-olds kids to learn? What fundamental concepts could I import to them that are sound enough to not be shaken by the brainwashing they'll get after they leave my classroom?
All right. They have to be ideas that are appropriate to the age group. So I think there are two that immediately come to my mind. The first is that age group can understand the broken window fallacy. In fact, that age group is just right, because I think they're just at the verge of, if you were to say to somebody, and they haven't been corrupted by society yet, so if you were to say to them, do you think it would make us all better off if we went around and smashed all the windows in here? I mean, do you think it would be, if I went to your house and I just set your furniture on fire? Like, do you think on balance that would make everybody better off? And they would immediately say, no, of course that's stupid, right? Who would think such a thing? You say, oh, unfortunately, 99% of the world. So you explain that, yes, you know, you break the window, but then now you have to, you know, instead of accumulating capital, you got to expend resources to go and fix it and whatever. So that would be the key thing is, and then I'm sure there are some good videos that depict the broken window fallacy and explain it. And the second thing would be try to get them to understand the principles in that iPencil essay so they see just the incredible miracles that go on every day by just the voluntary cooperation of people. And then you contrast that, try to find case studies of what happens when, you know, some politician's going to improve on this somehow, and the results are, you know, not so hot. So I think iPencil plus the broken window fallacy would be my entry-level stories for them.
Yeah, I actually have, not to be self-promoting here, but the Lessons for the Young Economist is a textbook that we wrote, you know, for the Institute aimed at a junior high level. So I would encourage you to look at that. We hit stuff like exchange and just really, you know, hammered that home about how can it be that when two kids at lunch exchange the sandwiches that their moms made for them, that they're both better off. You know, they can't both give each other the heavier sandwich. They can't both walk away with the heavier sandwich. That's impossible. but they can both walk away with the more valuable sandwich. And that seems odd, you know, just that kind of stuff. Division of labor, just walking through that, you know, when kids are doing the dishes after dinner and they don't each pick up a dish and walk into the kitchen, rinse it, and then dry it and put it. You know, normally it's like one kid's standing by the sink, one kid's bringing the stuff, one kid's drying. And so just walking through, like, why do you naturally do that? It's obvious why that's more productive. So there's, it's out there. You can peruse it for free.
Yeah, the one concept I would add, too, for that age group is teach them that in a free market, the only way to make money is to serve your fellow man, because they're going to be bombarded with pleas to be a public servant, serve the public by working for the government somehow. But I think it's important to understand that you have to serve your fellow man in a way that pleases him or her in order to make money. And that's just the opposite of sort of the Ralph Nader economics that says that businesses make money by poisoning their customers or that sort of thing. But I think that's very important because I have, you know, my college students, they all seem to be stunned when I say this to them, that, you know, because they're constantly being bombarded to volunteer to do this, volunteer to do that, which is fine. But they think service means sacrificing and suffering. And sometimes it does, but it can also mean being in business. And whoever, if that person is in here with a question, look at the lecture on Mises.org on the media by Rabbi Daniel Lappin. He gave a great lecture on, I think, what is it, In Defense of Economic Freedom or something like that is a title. And he tells all sorts of very interesting stories that any seventh grader can understand about the market and about how it really relies on serving your fellow man. Like Adam Smith said in The Wealth of Nations, give me that which I want, and I will give you that which you want. And that's capitalism.
Okay, question. In a Liberty classroom lecture on American history, the Soviet Union was called a paper tiger. Was the Soviet Union a threat through its spies? What should have been done, and thoughts on the Truman Doctrine? I suppose that's addressed to you.
Yeah, actually, I ended up answering this question for this person in person, but now that it's been raised, we may as well mention it. I think we can distinguish between two different ways in which the Soviet Union may have been a threat. One is militarily, and the other is through communist infiltration of various American institutions, including the American government. I do think there was some – I think at this point it's not even debatable that there was an attempt to infiltrate, and largely successful in some areas, indeed to infiltrate the U.S. government. Now, infiltrating the U.S. government, I'm not sure that's such a bad thing if you infiltrated it to dismantle it. If you infiltrated it to, you know, make it worse and put us in labor camps, I guess I am against that. So that, yes, that's one thing. But in terms of the Soviet Union as a threat to the U.S. in other ways, well, I mentioned that Yuri Maltsev is sort of the great expert in terms of the literature on this. But increasingly, it is being recognized that both left and right, as late as the 1980s, were overstating Soviet capabilities, each for their own reasons. The left felt compelled to boast of Soviet accomplishments so they could say, look, you see, an alternative to capitalism does work. I mean, yes, there are a lot of corpses, but they produce a lot of concrete. They have a lot of steel. And just to show, and Paul Samuelson, famously the Keynesian economist, in repeated editions of his economics textbook, talks about how successful and robust the Soviet economy is. But then the neoconservatives, who existed even then in the 70s and 80s, they were already there. They have their own reasons for wanting to exaggerate Soviet economic performance because they want to justify the American warfare state. So they have to say, oh, it's so robust and whatever. Now, you would think that people who believe in – supposed to at least give lip service to the free market would be slightly skeptical of the numbers coming out of the Soviet Union, that maybe they're not true or maybe they're meaningless, or, you know, I mean, a place where the joke was that you couldn't even get toilet paper You know, you'd have to wait all day long to get a roll of toilet paper. Like, this is the country you're terrified of, or this is a country that will take over some impoverished African country or some impoverished country in Southeast Asia, and this is supposed to be a threat? This is actually dragging them down. This is not a threat. Let them accumulate satellites like that if they want to. But then also, Ralph Rako has a good chapter in his book published by the Mises Institute called Great Wars and Great Leaders, A Libertarian Rebuttal. He has a chapter on Truman specifically where he goes through the evidence in terms of Soviet intentions. You don't have to be naive. You don't have to think Stalin was a great guy. But you do have to think that after suffering 27 million deaths, they might want to retrench for a while. Or the fact that they're tearing up the very railroad tracks that would have been necessary to launch a continental invasion might have been an indication that some of the Truman administration's fear-mongering was precisely that. So without going on for much longer, I'll just leave it there.
Let me just say three quick points, and then I'm sure these guys have more to say. One of the great things was Daniel Ellsberg's book. So he was the Pentagon Papers guy, and I read his – I think it was called Secrets that came out, I don't know, 10 years ago, something like that. And he points out in there that they were all working – I forget what you know, State Department, where he was working for, what agency, but well, Department of Defense, I guess. And they thought there was a so-called missile gap, that the Soviets had 10-to-1 advantage over, you know, long-range missiles or something. And then they got new intelligence – and they had been justifying, you know, saying to Congress, we need more funding because there's this missile gap. And then they got new intelligence saying, yeah, there is a 10-to-1 gap, and it's our advantage that we're producing, you know, we have that many, which again, like Tom's saying, that shouldn't surprise us, that we know capitalism is more productive than socialism, so of course we can produce more stuff. And they've said, but we still, you know, we didn't, it's not like the CIA and all the Defense Department said, okay, let's pull back then, that they were still pushed onward. Richard Feynman tells us, you know, he's a physicist who worked Los Alamos and all that stuff, and, you know, think about, where did the Soviets, how did they get the A-bomb? It's not because of those Russian scientists developed it. Oh, my gosh, they're going to – it's because the U.S. government, out of paranoia and then wanting to, you know, threatening – telling the scientists we need to develop this atomic weapon because the, you know, the bad guys are working on it, so we got to be able to build it first. So that's how they got all of these, you know, Jewish emigres and stuff to come, real smartest guys in the world to come and build it at huge taxpayer expense. And then the Soviets had spies, and that's how they built their – you know, that's how they built it first or got their – first prototypes is because they waited for the U.S. government to fund the thing and, you know, deal with all the problems and logistics. And Feynman talks about, you know, they tried 10 different ways at first, and it was only because they had so much money getting thrown at it that they were able, and they had been lied to and were told we're not going to use it once the Nazis are defeated, you know. And so anyway, I'm just saying, like, the conventional narrative is totally backwards in terms of what you think the threat is, and that, you know, if the U.S. had never funded it in the first place, could there be would the Soviets have had, or what year would they have had atomic weapons? It would have been a lot later if they had to build it themselves. And the last thing, I had a student who had grown up in Russia and came, and she told us that when they were young, you know, because I grew up in the 80s, and we saw movies like Top Gun and all these movies about, you know, fighting the Russians and stuff. Yeah, and, you know, I'm going to be an F-14 Tomcat and shoot my Sidewinder, you know, and you know, have Kenny Loggins singing in the background. And... And she was saying the same thing. When she grew up, they were taught that the Americans were the imperialist warmonger, and they were, you know, terrified of these evil Americans. You know, and at the time, I thought that was funny. Like, oh, yeah, Americans taking over the world. Oh, wait a minute. You know, so.
Well, the idea that there was some big economic competition between the Soviet Union and the United States was always stupid. It was always a propaganda ploy to pump up the Pentagon budget. And it was kind of an open secret in a way, but the CIA was the lead agency in developing this mythology of one gap after another, bomber gap, troop gap, missile gap, throw weight gap, submarine silence gap. It just went on and on and on. Every one of them was bogus. But the fact is that even though the Soviet Union was and remained essentially a third world country in terms of the level of living of the mass of the people, it did have thousands of nuclear weapons and ICBMs that would do what they said they would do. And that was an enormous threat to the United States and the world. And oddly enough, although the Cold War ended more than 20 years ago, that remains, in my view, the single overwhelmingly most important threat to humanity today, because the Russians and the Americans, and to some extent several other powers, have nuclear weapons and delivery systems that can be used, and if worse came to worse, used on a scale that would destroy humanity. And nobody thinks about this anymore. There are feeble efforts that go on to reduce the number of nuclear weapons and the size of the missile arsenals on both sides, the Russian side and the U.S. side, but they don't proceed very fast. And even today, both sides possess thousands of nuclear weapons, and you don't need thousands of weapons like that to reduce humanity to savagery on this planet because of the various ways in which they would do harm if very many of them were exploded. So there was a real threat. In my view, this was the only time in American history where, in a sense, the rulers were correct to tell us that, you know, they were defending our lives. They were doing it very badly and very dangerously, but nevertheless, there was a real threat. On all the other occasions, the threat was bogus. There wasn't ever a time when the Germans were going to invade the United States, or the Japanese were going to invade the United States, or the Mexicans, or the Canadians, or the Bulgarians were going to invade the United States and make us all speak Bulgarian. That was always nonsense in every case. But in the case of the Cold War, it was a real serious threat of death and destruction to us all.
This reminds me of this discussion reminds me of the chapter in Human Action on War and the Economy, where von Mises says that if you're going to wage war, say a defensive war, it's better to rely on capitalist enterprises rather than nationalizing industry, for the obvious reason that they're more efficient. But then he says that the downside, though, is capitalism is so good at it that it could produce weapons of mass destruction that could destroy the entire world. And this was many decades ago when he wrote this, but that's exactly what Bob is referring to now. That has happened. And our friend Yuri Maltsev, who worked for Mikhail Gorbachev and defected from the Soviet Union before the collapse, and who ended up being associated with the Mises Institute of all places. He tells a story of when he first defected. He was debriefing Dick Cheney, the defense secretary at the time, and Yuri tells me that he told Cheney that the Soviet economy was no more than 5% of the U.S. economy, and he says Cheney told him, well, our CIA says, no, it's more like 50%, so surely it's somewhere between 5 and 50, and Yuri said that, no, he was adamant, no, it's 5. Five, and he said Cheney's response was just to sit back and say, sweet. So he apparently convinced him that the Cold War really was unfundable, and over. And so, and I think Yuri is probably right about that, because he tells stories about how the people he worked with, and he didn't exactly work in a slum. He worked for the perestroika team for Gorbachev. And he said the secretaries, he caught his secretary once stealing light bulbs, unscrewing all the light bulbs. And he asked her, why are you unscrewing all the light bulbs and stealing them? And she said, there's nothing else left to steal. And so so by the late 80s, the Soviet economy just was almost non-existent, apparently. Although at that same time, Paul Samuelson was still publishing in his textbook some graph that had the Soviet economy being bigger than the U.S. economy at some certain date. He had this dumb graph that he stuck with for a long, long time into the 80s.
Okay, question. Though government spending decreased after World War II, it was still three times greater than pre-war levels, according to government numbers. So why did the economy bounce back so quickly? In other words, what ended the Great Depression? Okay, what ended the Great Depression? I think in the sense of, how did that actually work? And I think we've already addressed that question a little bit, but it's also true in current times that people say we can't balance the budget, because if we cut government spending by $700 billion, unemployment would get worse, we'd have less tax revenue, blah, blah, blah.
He said the death of FDR, and I mean that is a funny line, but it's also true. And I feel funny even talking about it because everything I know about this I got from him. So the worst I can do is reproduce it faithfully. So it's the because a lot of people. I mean, think about it, FDR was the only one who had gone more than two terms, which had been sort of a tradition, and he was doing this. Clearly unprecedented interventions in the markets and his throwaway comments, just very hostile to business owners and around the world, totalitarian governments were, you know, there. And so a lot of business people legitimately feared that FDR was going to be a dictator for the rest of his life. And so, you know, there was a real sense in which him dying and then someone else coming to power, like that was a passage of a regime and people might have thought, okay, property rights would be more secure. One other little just quibble about that. I mean, there's a difference in, like, let's say you had a government, it was 95% of GDP for 20 years, and, you know, we were in that new equilibrium, and then they cut government spending in half, private GDP growth would be huge, right? Because that's what typically when you say, is the economy growing, you know, they're meaning percentage rate of growth. So it's true, the economy in absolute terms in that year would not be bigger than it would have been in an alternate universe had the government remained really small. But the point is, if you had a huge government and then it shrinks, then you are going to see a spurt in conventional measures of economic growth and people, it's going to feel like prosperity.
In the late 30s, from 1935 at least, on for the rest of the 30s, the Roosevelt administration, not simply the president himself, but everybody associated with the administration was very hostile to investors as a class and in large part to business in general. And not only did they talk in a hostile way that has no precedent before or since in American politics, the president himself would make very threatening and menacing comments about business people and investors. But everybody who was running departments and running agencies and people in the Justice Department who were bringing cases and so forth, they were just hostile across the board. This was a sense in which the new dealers were called things like boys with their hair on fire. And this scared investors to death. And so investment never recovered in the 1930s. It never came close to recovering to where it had been in the late 20s, and particularly long-term investment, because, you know, you might be able to buy a new adding machine or something that was going to wear out in 5 years, but you certainly weren't going to pour concrete for a new factory building that needed to operate for 25 or 30 years to recover the investment cost. So long-term investment didn't recover particularly, and investment is the engine of economic growth, and that was above all why no real recovery occurred in the 30s. Now, when Roosevelt determined to go to war, which he did as soon as the war began in 1939, he knew that the United States did not have the military means, either the military industries or the uniformed forces at that time, to be a serious factor in the war. So he set about trying to move in that direction. But he encountered a lot of resistance from business people. Industrialists didn't want to have anything to do with the Roosevelt administration. He had been railing against them and threatening them for 5 or 6 years, and they didn't trust him. So even when the War Department went out to seek contracts, contractors for building up munitions factories or related materials plants, people didn't want the contracts. And after Stimson became Secretary of War in the middle of 1940, he bemoaned that Congress had appropriated a great deal of money for war, but the difficulty was turning that money into actual action by industrialists. And, of course, the industrialists had him over a barrel at that point. New Deal lawyers can't build and operate steel mills. You know, they can't build and operate aluminum factories. They can't do the things the country had to do to become a real power in a real war. So he had to make his peace with the business people. And the way he did that, he did it in a number of ways, but one way was he basically began to sack all these zealous new dealers and replace them with businessmen. And this went on very quickly in 1941, and then even more quickly in 1942, when practically all these people were swept out of the government entirely or put in harmless positions. And meanwhile, more than 10,000 businessmen had come into the war management agencies of the government, such as the War Production Board, to run the government's war economic command economy. So the regime uncertainty that had been built up in the late 1930s was dispelled because businessmen were running the economy now. But this had no outlet because the resources of the economy were being devoted almost entirely to war purposes, except for the minimal amount that had to be allowed to civilians to keep them from becoming rebellious or restive. Now, when the war ends, what we've got now is that we no longer have a New Deal government. We no longer have all these zealous New Dealers running the federal state, but instead we have a much friendlier, business-friendlier federal government. The regime uncertainty was not totally eliminated, but it was greatly diminished, and at the same time, resources were once again made available for civilian use. As Tom mentioned, there was a drastic reduction in a single year in government spending, which meant overwhelmingly war spending. So that's why we had this recovery. We no longer had the regime uncertainty that had paralyzed recovery before, and we were now in a position to run a civilian economy for the first time since 1939. So at least that's the general kind of explanation I advance in my work and in my book, Depression, War, and Cold War.
Any questions from the audience?
I have two questions. In first, I will play like devil's advocate in the... So the question is, if like a libertarianism or anarcho-capitalism is such a good thing, why we are not living in anarcho-capitalistic society right now? Maybe statism is in the human nature and can't be eliminated. And the second question is just plain, what do you think anarcho-capitalists or libertarians should vote or not? Thank you very much.
I'll take a stab at the first one. Maybe these guys have a pithier response. I mean, if you went back to when slavery characterized all the major civilizations, said, you know, if freedom is so good or not having slavery is so good, how come there's slavery all over the place? Clearly, this is the natural condition of humanity. I mean, that might have sounded like a compelling argument at the time, but in retrospect, we think it isn't. So, I mean, it's, you know, 200 years from now, after there's a bustling anarcho-capitalist paradise in Panama, people are, you know, we're going to realize that's a silly argument. But so there's that. And I don't vote. I mean, it's the only reason I ever did vote was so that if I was at a party or something and somebody said, who are you going to vote for? That, you know, first of all, I could correct them and say, for whom am I going to vote? And then that would have something to, you know, to be able to plausibly say. But now, I mean, it's just as interesting or not as interesting to say, well, actually, I don't vote, and let me tell you why, you know. So, and also, I don't go to parties that much.
Although he will be at a party tonight, right? It's so Wild Bob will be on stage, actually, at some point.
Get your wristband.
Well, I wrote an article years ago on lewrockwell.com called Be Patriotic, Don't Vote. And it's basically a repetition of Lysander Spooner's old argument that if what government is doing is perpetrating a tyranny, what you do when you vote is you add credibility to the regime. Because after the election, don't they always say, the people have spoken, we want socialized medicine, or the people have spoken, they want us to bomb Syria, or whatever the agenda is. And so in the U.S. especially, we have an unlimited government now. The Constitution has not limited government in any real way for a long, long time. And so when you vote, you just add credibility to the regime. And so if you think of yourself as a patriot, the thing to do is don't go anywhere near a voting booth and just stay away. And if only five people showed up to vote, they would never be able to say the people have spoken, our power, you know, is behind us. And so now when our government, the U.S. government, bombs all these countries in the Middle East and murders children by the hundreds or thousands and other innocents, other people and some people in those countries feel totally within their rights to randomly murder Americans, because after all, we have spoken. We have ratified what our government does with all the bombing and all the wars, haven't we? And so it makes it's a very dangerous game to participate in democracy.
You know, the argument you raised as devil's advocate, if free societies are good, why aren't there any, is not compelling in a way because of what Tom said, that at any given moment in history, there are many things that look as if they're natural, as if they're sort of aspects of human nature. And later, as we look back, we see that they've been abandoned. And so it's clear that short term is not enough to judge what is natural and, you know, what must inevitably be part of human society. That some experiments, in a sense, take a long time before we know the final answer as to how they're going to work out. And I think many of us believe that the experiments that have been going on here for the past 1 to 2 centuries all over the world in the growth of statism are destined to fail. Right now, today, they haven't failed yet. Statism is still rampant everywhere. But that in itself doesn't tell us that it will not fail in the future. And I think many of us can see good reasons to expect that ultimately it must fail, reasons of the same kind that Mises advanced when he explained the socialist calculation problem. Socialism cannot calculate. It's destined to be inefficient. It's destined to be poor. It's destined to be without innovation and entrepreneurship. And what we've done is we've, by giving the state more and more control over the economies of all the countries in the world, we've created conditions in which the sources of economic growth have been eliminated or diminished. Entrepreneurship, inventiveness, reallocation of resources to more efficient purposes, reorganization of production and what have you, all the things that historically entrepreneurs and inventors have carried out to create the modern world and all of its affluence. But there is such a thing as squeezing the neck of the goose so hard that finally it not only stops laying the golden eggs, but actually falls over dead. And I think what is happening now is more and more squeezing of that goose's neck, and it will drop dead eventually. So, and when that happens, we'll look around and say, ah, statism has passed away. It's revealed itself as a type of organization of society that produces, in the end, poverty, war, conflict, and a lot of other bad things. I don't think it's going to happen in the next decade. I think it may take a long time. But I think ultimately it will take place for very Misesian reasons.
Yeah, I'd like to try my hand at both of these. To add to what the other gentleman said, for the first question, I would say that we also need to factor in education, given that everybody, practically, I mean, if we want to round it off to 100%, basically, everybody is in some type of government school. Now, there are some people who are homeschooled. There are some people in private school. But the vast majority of people are in government schools, and even those in private schools are often using government school textbooks. So what we are raised to believe, basically every one of us, is raised to believe something like the following, that if it weren't for the political class, and so I don't just mean Barack Obama, I mean John McCain, I mean George W. Bush, I mean Nancy Pelosi. If it weren't for these people, everybody would be earning 10 cents an hour, and his 7-year-old child would be laboring away in a coal mine and getting their limbs blown off in mining accidents, and our computer monitors would be exploding in our faces, and all the sandwiches we eat would be poisoned, and there would be no art anywhere, and there'd be no science, and we'd all be ignoramuses. But thank heavens, these wonderful people come to rescue you, right? Is there anybody who wasn't taught that? I mean, this, we all get this. So naturally, what is your conclusion going to be? Right? I mean, most people tend to go with the flow. There are very few Rothbards in the world who say, wait a minute, not only do I not believe this, I think everything you've just said is false and the exact opposite is true. Very hard to crack out of that kind of conventional wisdom where we're all taught to believe that sort of thing. So what I mean, a lot of us have given speeches. I gave a talk in Texas last year where it was the Libertarian Party convention, and they asked me to speak. So I gave the keynote thing there. And I wasn't talking about voting. I was talking about – I said, here's how I would pitch this if the general public were listening to me for 30 or 35 minutes. Here's how I'd pitch it to them. And it was basically a summary of how I've come to think about this stuff after years and years of thinking about it. And I look back on it, and it's like the best thing I've ever done. It's called The Libertarian Speech I Would Deliver to the Whole Country on YouTube. And I really like it. And I think if people heard it, no, not everybody would become a libertarian instantly, but right away there'd be question marks in their head instead of just nodding their heads. You know, instead of just a period, there'd be a question mark. But those questions just don't get asked. And if they are asked, in fact, people aren't even led to believe that the questions exist. But the other thing is in terms of voting. Now, I want to dissent from Tom here. I generally don't vote either. So what I'm going to say is largely theoretical here. So I voted for Ron Paul in 2008. I didn't vote for him in 2012 because I moved to another state where they have a caucus instead of a primary. And during the caucus in Kansas, I was here at the Mises Institute for the Austrian Scholars Conference, so I was not available. You can't vote by absentee in a caucus, so I couldn't vote for him. But I voted for him in 2008 basically because he was working so hard for a guy in his 70s, combing the country, being made fun of by intellectual and moral pygmies and criticized by idiots. And he's out there defending peace and prosperity against the worst warmongering scum of the earth imaginable. And I thought that by casting my vote and having his number be a tiny peck upward, that would be my way of saying thank you for doing this. And would also show the rest of the world that, yes, not all of us are insane lunatics. I thought that meant something. You know, I wanted to say that. And then, but also, again, specifically this, he was so heroic on the war issue. I did not believe I was legitimizing the regime by casting my vote any more than if I were in a concentration camp and they gave me the opportunity to vote on whether I should be released. Should I say, nope, if I were to vote on this, I'd be legitimizing the whole concentration camp system. So I abstain from voting. The rest of you can vote and leave, but I'm going to stay here and be imprisoned. I don't think I'm lending legitimacy to that. So, but given that there's nobody like Ron Paul around anymore, and people will object, well, isn't there this guy and that guy? I don't really feel strongly enough about anybody else. So I'm probably never going to vote again. But in theory, I just don't think that you're legitimizing the system. I know I have a minority view around here, but that's my position.
Ladies and gentlemen, that is the end of round two. Thank you for your questions.